Have you ever felt a twinge of worry about AI taking over your job or diluting your creativity? Well, what if you could turn that fear into creative fuel? We've just published an amazing new ebook called The 4 Keys to Success in an AI World, and this is more than just a guide. It's a deep exploration into the human skills that AI can't touch, the skills that are essential for standing out and thriving no matter how much technology evolves. We're talking about real differentiators here like creativity, emotional intelligence, critical thinking, and much more. Inside, you'll find actionable insights and strategies to develop these skills, whether you're a creative person, a business person, or just simply someone who loves personal development. This isn't a story about tech taking over. It's a story of human creativity thriving alongside AI. Picture this: AI as your creative co-pilot, not just as a tool, but a collaborator that enhances your unique human skills. The 4 Keys ebook will show you exactly how to do that and view AI in a new way that empowers you instead of overshadows you. Transform your creative potential today. Head over to unmistakablecreative.com/4keys. Use the number 4, KEYS. That's unmistakablecreative.com/4keys. And download your free copy.
Early on, I was standing by one of our fountains, and I overheard somebody say, "Wow, I never knew water could do that before." And that phrase struck into my mind. I thought, maybe that should be our judgment if we hear that. So we take one of the most ordinary substances on the planet. We all take it for granted. We don't normally look at it even twice. And if we can bring out an aspect of its personality or its essence or its being, that will be a pretty good achievement. And then I had, in the fairly early days of the company, we'd done, maybe a couple dozen features. And someone called me up, somebody that I guess I'd gone to school with, and said, "I just saw a fountain, shopping center. Was that yours?" And I said, "Yes, it was." He said, "I knew it. I know your work. And there's just some quality to it that without reading a sign or anything, it's yours." So we always look for those ways of just catching, you know, people's interest in the most ordinary thing in the world and allowing them to see it freshly with the, you know, the eyes of a child when you see something new for the first time. That's a challenge because water's all around us, but that's really the goal.
I'm Srini Rao, and this is the Unmistakable Creative Podcast, where you get a window into the stories and insights of the most innovative and creative minds who've started movements, built thriving businesses, written best-selling books, and created insanely interesting art. For more, check out our 500-episode archive at unmistakablecreative.com. Mark, welcome to the Unmistakable Creative. Thanks so much for taking the time to join us.
Well, it's such a treat to be here. Thank you for having me.
It is my pleasure to have you here. So I found out about you by way of your publicist. And when I saw the words, "the guy who designed the fountains of the Bellagio," I was like, what? I'm like, that is a spectacle of epic proportions. Whoever can create something like that is somebody I have to talk to. But before we get into all that, I wanted to start by asking, what is one of the most important things that you learned from one or both of your parents that have influenced and shaped who you've become and what you've ended up doing with your life?
You know, it was probably, by example, hard work. My dad is a recession child. He wanted to be a writer, a very good writer, got a number of stories published, was partway through a book, and then the recession came, and he had a big family, quit, and, you know, had to work, and he would, late at night, I'd hear the old Royal typewriter down in the den clicking away, But dad would, and he was a great dad. He would, you know, want to play catch with me in the weekends and all that stuff. But then he'd go back in, have dinner, and he'd be at his desk doing work. And my mom worked for the FBI up until 2 weeks or 3 weeks or something like that before I was born. They weren't female agents in those days, but and there weren't cell phones either. So she was on the other end of a landline, and the agents, if they were on a hot case, had to call in every hour, so, you know, somebody knew they weren't shot or whatever. And she worked the Bugsy Malone case with the agents in the field, and she on the inside. So that's some hard work too.
Yeah. What advice did they give you about potential career paths? Because, I mean, what you do for a living is not something that anybody would pick out of a, you know, high school guidance counselor's list of recommendations. I mean, which is pretty much like anybody I've interviewed. It's not, you know, a career that you end up in by, right, by choice. It seems like almost accidental.
You know, the answer to that is they didn't push me into anything, but whatever I wanted to do, and a few of the possible choices along the way were a bit on the crazy side. They were just 100% supportive. And I was one of those kids. Well, you know how many people you ask today, even young people when they're, I don't know, upper teens, "What do you want to be when you grow up?" And you get a lot of, gee, I don't knows, or I don't know, I guess I'll go into business, which I don't have a super love for hiring MBAs because I figured that was typically the default category for people never knew what they wanted to do when they grew up.
Yeah,
that's rude, but I'll say it anyway. I can remember when I was little going to the kids' library I fell in love with Roy Chapman Andrews, who was a paleontologist who discovered the first dinosaur egg in the Gobi Desert. And then I fell in love with spelunking and thought I wanted to be a cave explorer all my life. Then I wanted to be a chemist. But it always came back to it, to kind of circled around something. When we were nine, we went to Disneyland for the first time. Now, this is a drive across the desert, no divided freeway or anything, because this would have been in the early 60s, from Salt Lake City to Los Angeles. We would leave at no air conditioning in our second or third hand car. We'd leave about 4 in the morning to get past the worst of the desert heat. And we pulled up at Disneyland and we walked through that gate. And I was nine. I thought, this is, if you can't be God, literally, being Walt Disney, or at least working for him and creating, you know, magical lands and places and experiences has got to be it. So I always circled back to that. And of course, I did spend 5 or 6 years working there, which I was lucky to do.
Hmm. Well, I mean, I think that what is striking to me about this story is that you had this sort of moment when you were really young. And I think a lot of people have those, but most people don't recognize them for what they are. And often do nothing with them. Why do you think that you had the foresight to see that there's something just magical about what you saw here and that would shape what you wanted to do with your life?
I think I was born gifted with an intense sense of curiosity. And that is such a driver. So I would, watch Don Herbert, who was Mr. Wizard or something, on Saturday morning TV. And I get really interested in that. And then in those days, you could buy some rather dangerous chemicals in the kids' chemistry set. And so I just want to find out about that. Let me turn the clock back for you. When I went to the University of Utah, which is as a state resident, wonderful, wonderful campus, big campus, tuition was, I think, $145 a quarter.
Wow.
So even though we were on the poor side, it was no rush to get through college to, you know, because you couldn't afford the tuition. So my degree in civil engineering, which is a 4-year degree, I took 5.5 years to complete, not because I was on the dumb side, but because I fell in love with other disciplines. I took, as a civil engineer, you have to take 3/4 of physics. I took 12, and some of them were in optics, and it was just fascinating, I thought. And then that was the time when the original television version of Mission Impossible came out, and they would do you remember the latex masks and the disguises and all that great stuff. And so I went waltzed into the theater department. I found the professor there who taught lighting design and stage makeup, Bill Barber. It turns out, and I took classes from him as a civil engineer. It turns out he would disappear every once in a while for a few weeks because he was employed by the CIA to help disguise their agents. So he's a very interesting guy. But those are the crazy things you find if you don't tether yourself to racing through school. My son's in college now. My daughter will begin in a year. And when we go through these orientations, one of the recurring themes, maybe it's the high cost of tuition, but the counselors will say, well, if you really focus, you might get your degree in 3.5 years. And we've told our kids, don't waste it, but it's an opportunity to try things, to learn things. Take 5 years or a little more, and stuff way out of your presumed major.
Yeah, it's funny because I've talked to numerous people about this, and you know the way our education system socializes us is to commit to a path, and it actually discourages curiosity and exploration. You know, it's kind of in a lot of ways like a fast food menu. It's like here are the majors you could choose, here are the potential career paths that you know they might lead to, and you know people are kind of forced into boxes so early in their lives. I mean, when I went to go speak to my high school AP English teacher's class after I got my book deal, I was amazed at how worried they were about what they planned to do with their lives. I'm like, you haven't even left high school yet. Granted, I know this all too well because that's what I was like at 20. Why do you think that is? I mean, and if you, you know, as somebody who had this experience of really, you know, taking a more exploratory approach to college. What would you change and how would we go about doing that more importantly?
Well, that's such a great question, particularly now since, you can tell I'm a big proponent of education. I'm tossing in my mind the current administration's plan for a lot more preschool. And I'm thinking, is that good or will that, I mean, you have to almost audition to get in a good preschool. And then most of those 2 years are spent preparing you to get into a school with a good kindergarten. And that's spent preparing you to get into a great middle school, which is spent preparing you to get into a fabulous high school, which is, I don't have to finish that paragraph, right? And then I guess it's all just, if you really just run that out, it's just preparing you to get buried at a fabulous funeral home, right? Well, I mean, where does that stop? Where can you start living in the present instead of preparing for the next stage? Yeah. It's such a waste of time. I don't mean it's a waste of time to be active and learning, but if you're focused on tomorrow, you don't even notice today.
Yeah. And you know, it's funny because I think for young people, especially ambitious ones, you know, I went to what is arguably an elite school, which is Berkeley. I mean, it's not Harvard or Stanford or Yale, but in environments like that, people are incredibly future oriented. They really don't. And I know this because that was me. So I guess the thing I wonder, I mean, based on your experience, the fact that you have kids, what would you say to parents who are listening to this about encouraging exploration and curiosity in their kids?
Well, I was trying to make a point to some younger people the other day about, and there was talk about, well, do I really want to get them into PhD? And you know, that's great, but it's sort of like, well, the classic saying is you learn more and more about less and less until you know absolutely everything about absolutely nothing. We were walking along and I was looking down the sidewalk and there were some cracks between the pieces of concrete and the stones nearby. And I said, let's look for life. Look down at your feet. Where do you see a little blade of grass or a little dandelion or something sprouting up? Not out of the middle of a big old block of granite or cement, but where those two, maybe a stone is butting up against a tree root or something. And I tried to spin that into the metaphor of the most interesting stuff in new life comes when two dissimilar objects or fields of study or human beings bump into each other. And one of the really fun things about WET for me, I say, boy, if you're ever out and have the time to come by sometime, I'd love to show you through. But we have a super fun campus, and we don't, discipline-wise, we don't have a lot of anybody, but by golly, we've got one of just about everybody. I mean, we've got, you know, textile designers, optical engineers, firmware developers, painters, illustrators, dance choreographers. I mean, you could thumb through, well, in my day, thumb through the physical college catalog today, scan it online. And I mean, we've had, I don't think we have an astronaut at the moment. We've got an Academy Award winner, So You Think You Can Dance winner. I mean, when we're doing fountain design, you go figure out how that comes together. But it does. I always like to refer to Steve Jobs' fabulous commencement talk, where he reminds everybody that he was a computer guy, but he stuck his nose into a calligraphy class and decided to just sneak in and audit it. And that later became the genesis for the whole, beautiful written form of script on the Mac instead of the typewritery kind of monospaced lettering. And I spoke to a group of engineering students earlier this week, came by for tour, and I said, anything that interests you, learn it, throw yourself into it. Don't have somebody say, well, what does that have to do with your major? I made them all a promise that whatever they learn, they will use at some point in their life. And that may be the thing that distinguishes them from the folks who just followed the yellow brick road.
Many of us have those stubborn pounds that seem impossible to lose, no matter how good we eat or how hard we work out. My solution is PlushCare. PlushCare is a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. They can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Plus, they accept most insurance plans. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Mm. Hello Fresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
If you're struggling to lose weight, you've probably heard about weight loss medications like Wegovy or Zepbound, and you might be wondering if they're right for you. Meet PlushCare, a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. If you qualify, they can safely prescribe you medication from the comfort of your own home. To get started, visit PlushCare.com/weightloss. That's PlushCare.com/weightloss. PlushCare.com/weightloss.
With LinkedIn Jobs, we tap into a network of more than a billion professionals to help you find quality professionals quickly and easily for any role you need. Marketing wizards? Found them.
Software engineers?
Found.
That project manager I could never seem to hire?
And found. LinkedIn Jobs quickly matches your roles with candidates with the right skills and experience. In fact, 86% of small businesses get a qualified candidate within 24 hours. Post your first job for free and get started at linkedin.com/spoken. That's linkedin.com/spoken. Terms and conditions apply.
Normally, being a little extra might be a bit much, but not when it comes to healthcare. That's why UnitedHealthcare's Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, supplement your primary plan so you manage out-of-pocket costs. Learn more at uh1.com.
As creators, we're always on the move. Whether it's a live podcast event, a pop-up shop, or a workshop, we're constantly interacting with community, and that's where Tap to Pay on iPhone and Stripe comes in. Imagine this, you're at a live event, a listener loves your merch, or a participant wants to sign up for your course on the spot. With Tap to Pay on iPhone and Stripe, you can accept their payments right there and then, right from your iPhone, so there's no extra hardware or no delays. Total game changer. It's not just for creators. Any business owner can do this. It's about making transactions smoother and much more personal, growing your business in your way. We've been using Stripe for our products and courses for a long time, and now with Tap to Pay on iPhone, you can take your business to the next level too. So visit stripe.com/tapiphone to learn more. Remember folks, with Tap to Pay on iPhone and Stripe, your business is always at your fingertips.
You know, it's funny you say that because I have an econ degree and I thought, what a useless degree. I'm never going to use this. I still to this day remember sitting in a final class at Berkeley. It was environmental economics, and I'm sitting here listening to this guy talk to me about how to use a utility function to maximize the amount of milk that I can get out of a cow. And I'm thinking, when the hell is this ever going to matter? And then I went back and I read The Wealth of Nations recently, and it was one of the things where I started to just see my business through that lens. And I realized, I was like, oh, wow, that degree actually came back full circle, but it took almost 20 years.
Yeah, yeah. What's the series of books Thinkonomics, something crazy nomics, and it's written by a couple of economists who just analyze the darndest things, through that economic lens. Yeah. So absolutely. It's just, it's a different camera lens to look at life through, and you see it very differently. It's like looking with an infrared lens or something that is not visible light at a subject you're used to seeing in RGB.
Yeah. Well, I mean, speaking of looking at the world through different lenses, the average civil engineer doesn't become a fountain designer. They usually are, building bridges. How in the world do you get from studying civil engineering to designing fountains?
Well, if I may, I'll take two little short snippets along the way.
Yeah.
There was a bit of what did you call it? Method to my madness. See, when I was, I'm not a genius by any stroke. I just tell everybody I work really hard. But so I'm in civil engineering, and I've got a pretty good technical mind, pretty good background. But when we had to give class presentations, oh my gosh, are they boring? Because engineers aren't really into standing up; they're scared to be in front of people or what have you. And then I was taking these classes over in theater, and over there, of course, it's all about being on stage and presenting. But they couldn't build the simplest prop in the world and have it not fall apart. So I could have been a relatively, I hate to use the word mediocre, let's say mediocre plus engineer, and been a superhero in all my theater classes. And I could have made kick-ass presentations. I not only could, but did presentations in engineering because of my theater background. So sometimes it's good, to step across the border and enjoy the fun of being there. Also, a few in those days, I hope it's sincerely improved, but in those days, there were a little better dating choices in the theater department for an engineer than there were in his own field. Oh, but the story I was going to tell you about supporting parents. So mom and dad, they and it wasn't a lot of cost. I lived at home and I went through university there. And then I applied to a number of schools and a professor said, you really ought to think of Stanford. It's a very interesting school. So I applied and was accepted there, obviously in civil engineering. And so we're driving again across the desert, this time the Salt Flats, going to Northern Cal. And I remember sitting, I can picture sitting, my dad was driving, mom was on the right side, and I was sitting behind dad. And I took a deep breath and I said, Dad? Yeah? Dad, I don't think I want to be a civil engineer. Now, the tuition at Stanford was not $145 a quarter. Yeah. You know, it was, here we're going to deplete the family savings. He said, why don't you want to do that? And I said, well, you know, if you're a civil engineer, basically your goal is to design and build things that do not move. I mean, bridges, you do not want them to move. Skyscrapers, you do not want them to move, right? As in tip over. And I said, I like moving things. I like moving stuff. So I want to poke around when I get there. And I went and saw the dean of engineering when I got there and shared that story in a little more serious vein. And he said, what are your GREs? And I had a pretty good score. So he said, oh, you can be whatever you want. So I went into mechanical engineering. And there was an orientation, and the head of the mechanical engineering division said, well, we have three groups here. We have machine design, which I thought, well, that sounds like me. And then we have the thermodynamics stuff, the heat and the energy and stuff. And I was, that's amazing, but it wasn't my cup of tea. And he said, then we've got a third little group, and I don't even know how to describe them, so I'm going to let Dr. McKim, who heads it up, describe it. It's called product design. And he said, we really don't claim them completely because they're half in the College of Engineering and half in the College of Fine Arts. And I thought, boy, this sounds great. It was a 2-year master's program instead of the one, so I had to break that double X news to my folks tuition-wise. But there again, you know, it was this cross-fertilization, and I struggled because I didn't have a lot of art training with all my engineering studies. If you came through WET, you'd see it patterned on many of the things that I learned at Stanford in that bizarre program. One of the professors, Dr. Fadiman, well, he was on loan to the engineering school, but he was from the Department of Psychology. And we just had crazy, crazy professors from all over campus come in and kind of stir the pot. The whole program was about, you know, being creative, inventive, and stepping across the line. And so, and then I went to Disney. And at that time, particularly, I mean, Walt Disney was no longer with us, but I got to work with most of his peers, you know, who are still there, and a rich, creative bunch. So I've been very, very blessed with the experiences I've had. I think I just keep my eyes open for them. I mean, I do that at least and try to step into those calligraphy rooms that Steve Jobs peeked into when I see one with the door cracked open.
Yeah. So how do you get from Disney to you know, WET? I mean, like, I am so fascinated by, you know, the work that, you know, like people do with water in particular. As a 10-year surfer, I have this just, you know, immense love for anything water. And I still to this day remember the first time I saw the fountains at the Bellagio. And I remember sitting there. It was probably when I was in college. I was with my parents. And I'm like, you know what, Dad? I was a freshman in college. And I was like, I'm going to be a billionaire and I'm going to have whoever designed this in front of my house. And he just looked at me and rolled his eyes. He was like, that's great. But I, to this day, like, it's just one of those things that, you know, like, I don't really like Vegas, but that is one of those most beautiful things I've ever seen. But how do you go from Disney to this? And then I really want to get into the actual creative process for how all this happens.
Sure. Well, thank you for saying that. I will say one thing. There are, I'm sure, shorter, faster, better ways to getting to be a billionaire than going into the fountain business. I always liked to play with water as a kid. Dad built for my brother and I a really cool sandbox behind the garage. And I, first thing I did was screw two garden hoses together so they'd reach and flood it, you know, and then build sand dams, and which I guess a little of my pre-civil engineering coming up. And play in the snow and build. I remember building some kind of ice dams after big storms so that all the cars driving down the hill that we were, our house was near on the road, would have to swerve out of the way of the big lake I could dam. So there's something about water that's has always been fascinating to me. And then in civil engineering, well, one of the reasons also it took me a little longer. I was the first civil engineer in the history of the University of Utah to go through the honors program, which is an accoutrement, I mean, an add-on to any other degree, but it's intense liberal arts. And I thought, I don't know why, somebody talked me into it. And a couple of great things came out of it, by the way. The classes, University of Utah had, probably in those days even 40,000 students or something. Except for one chemistry class, I don't think I ever had a class my whole university. There were more than like 15 people. I had a few classes at four. So I really, that made the experience really rich. Then I went to expensive Stanford and I was in huge classes a lot. But I had that honors program, but that required us to actually write and publish a written thesis, not for a master's degree, but for a baccalaureate degree. And so I say it was the first. I had a friend who was also in the program, and we did it together, and we were trying to think of what to do for a thesis. We were sitting in the back of a fluid mechanics class. In those days, nothing on video. It was the old 16-millimeter click, 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 you know, black and white films to show things. And the lesson was a little movie on something called laminar flow, which is if you take all the turbulence out of water, it's kind of like if you take all the turbulence out of light, you get a laser. All the little photons are moving, you know, the same. It's just the beam. Well, you can sort of do the same thing with water. And Dave Ayer, my friend, wanted to become an architect, and I wanted to go to Disney. And we thought, what can we do? And the other kids were talking about thesis projects and sewage treatment plants, whatever. Let's see if we could scale that up to human size, architectural size, and make these clear streams of water. And in the film, they're like matchstick size, right? This is like 3-inch high stream about the diameter of a toothpick. And so we set about to do that, and we did. And the dad of a friend of my girlfriend at the time was building a little new apartment building, and he gave us some money to actually build a model of our thesis project in the lobby, which was super fun. So why am I telling all that? Oh, fountains. So I have a thesis published on axisymmetric laminar fluid flow applied in an artistic or architectural installation. And then when I went to Stanford and had to do a lot of different projects, I pursued that as one path. And then when I interviewed at Disney, I instead of just having a resume with classes and grades. I had a lot of projects because I'm a real project kid, but I showed that off and got hired in there.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot. We charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
If you're struggling to lose weight, you've probably heard about weight loss medications like Wegovy or Zepbound, and you might be wondering if they're right for you. Meet PlushCare, a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. If you qualify, they can safely prescribe you medication from the comfort of your own home. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss. plushcare.com/weightloss.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic-butter shrimp scampi. Mm. Hello Fresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
Many of us have those stubborn pounds that seem impossible to lose, no matter how good we eat or how hard we work out. My solution is PlushCare. PlushCare is a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. They can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Plus, they accept most insurance plans. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
A lot can happen in the next 3 years. Like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans are available for these changing times. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer budget-friendly, flexible coverage for people who are in between jobs or missed open enrollment. The plans last nearly 3 years in some states, with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. So for whatever tomorrow brings, UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans may be for you. Learn more at uh1.com.
So what I wonder is, you know, so like I said, when I saw this for the first time, you know, of course, I didn't have the sort of creative insight that I do now from thousands of interviews. But, you know, just to understand what the hell goes into something this complex. I mean, you know, like you mentioned, you know, you have all these people because you, I think that that has always been the thing now that I'm talking to you that has struck me about it is you take something that is, you know, basically, you know, a material and you humanize it in a way, mm-hmm. you know, you bring water to life. It's like, wow, these are, you know, like every section of that fountain, it's like, oh, there's a person dancing, like you the music, all of it. I mean, so start, which I realize is an insane question, but like, how does it even start? Like, how do you conceive an idea this grand? And you know, was it Steve Wynn coming to you and be like, yo, I need you to build this? Or you, how does it even begin?
Well, that one began, we had done some smaller projects as well. I don't remember how many people we had under, probably 30 people or something maybe in the company in those days. And Don Brinkerhoff was a very well-known landscape architect and had done Steve's properties. He'd done the landscaping around the Mirage Hotel and so forth. And I guess Steve told him, Don, I want to build a big lake. I got this idea of doing kind of this Italian-themed hotel called Bellagio. And Steve was thinking of, maybe we'll put water skiers out front or whatever. But maybe I'd like to try a fountain. And Don said, well, you got to talk to Mark Fuller. I've done a couple of projects with him. So Steve flew my wife and I up there. And we had a dinner. And Steve is, I've learned a lot from him. He's amazing. He's very nearly blind from retinitis pigmentosa. Never complains about it at all. But so he's very visionary, and he knows what will touch and appeal to people. And he said, Mark, he said, I want to do this big lake. And it has to be, when the people are there, they have to feel they're not in Las Vegas. We're not going to do colored lights. We're not going to do flashing anything. It has to completely remove you from that experience. And he said, the other requirement is, I love music, because he was buddies with Frank Sinatra and the Rat Pack and just a bunch of people through his life. It has to be integrally tied to music in a very sophisticated way. And thirdly, you have to promise me it'll be the best and biggest thing you'll ever do in your life. you know, that's an interesting promise to try to make somebody like Steve Wynn.
Yeah.
But and he said, and he said, this is a big deal to me. It was 3 years before the hotel would open. And he said, I've never been really happy with the volcano in front of the a mirage. It sort of looks like a you know, big rock thing with colored water squirting out of the top. So let's try getting to know each other. And why don't you take, I don't remember what he gives, a year or something, and see what you can do that. So we redid that. We had a lot of and then we built a big mock-up here in our parking lot, and Steve and his family came down. I mean, this is my theater, see, prop building and set building. And Steve, when we invited him down, he said, I was expecting to see something the size of a coffee table, and you're going to show me how the water looks like lava or something. No, this was as big as, I don't know what I want to say, a two-story, two-stack garage or something, all sculpted and lit. And we're in Hollywood, right? So even then, I a lot of my friends and stuff were scenic designers. And we blew Steve away, and he admitted that. And that's a hard thing to do. I guess that's, and if I'm going to slip another piece of advice into anybody who's listening, it's always try to really surprise the heck out of people by, you know, going further than even maybe you yourself expected. First of all, it's just plain fun. And second of all, it guarantees you that your competition. And see, I don't think of our competition aware as being other fountain companies, because a bunch of them copy, you know, one way or good or bad or not very much. So what we've done in the past, but if you were to ask me, well, Mark, who's your biggest competitor? I would say the last project we did, because the world expects us now to top that with the next one. Like I said, they probably say that to Steven Spielberg or something, right, about making movies. And so that started us. We did that. He loved the Mirage. Steve was very leery of technology. He's very much a showman. And one of the hardest challenges, and if you remember standing there, you don't see any nozzles come up out of that lake surface. Yeah. It's just a beautiful lake. And getting those little babies to appear on cue and disappear, and there are thousands of them, was as hard as any other aspect of the fountain. And I learned that from Steve. I think whatever few fountains we'd done before that, the nozzles probably all poked up. But that gives the whole weight thing away. You can say, oh, there's going to be a circle of jets here or something. It's like if you had all the actors and props on the stage for every scene of a play or something, you know, it wouldn't be anything left to your imagination or surprise in the next scene.
Yeah.
And then he was really afraid. We flew to Disneyland together, and we showed him what we call the shooters. Those are the big ones that go up like rockets. They're very, I call them the staccato part of the fountain, you know, boom. They're fired by compressed air, which is amazingly green and energy efficient compared to pumps and the traditional ways of moving water. But I said, Steve, we need the legato side too, to do music well. And we developed these, kind of underwater robots, the ones that you can see sway around. And there's a whole story that I won't take the time to tell you. I went back to the University of Utah and had one of my college professors help us there, who had a small company on robotics. But and that's what came out of it. A lot of it didn't work of the first time. I mean, it did work by opening day, but, you know, right up till it, you've got 216 of these underwater robots that have never been done before that have to move with the grace of a ballet dancer. We learned a lot of choreography on that from Kenny Ortega, who was, if you know the name.
Yep, yeah. Michael Jackson.
Kenny, exactly. Kenny and I are going to Dubai a week after next together. It will be really fun. We've worked together on and off ever since then. But he said, wow. Mark, he said, I can get humor, I can get melodrama, I can get grandeur out of your jets, just like I can out of a human performer. And of course, that's what we strive to do.
Wow. Okay, so many questions come from that. First, briefly about Stephen, what is it that enables somebody at his level to achieve at the level that he does? Because from what little research I've done, I know there have been a few books written about him. There's not a whole hell of a lot you can find about the guy, and I wonder if that's by design. But from what I'm told, he was a tobacco salesman in Las Vegas who basically, you know, became this cultural icon. What is it enables, like the visionary thinking of somebody who is like that?
Oh, that's a good question. I've spent a lot of time with Steve. During the Bellagio, his CFO came out to me once and said, Mark, you do know Steve's spending more time with you than he is with his wife. That's amazing. but he wasn't a tobacco salesman, but it was a liquor delivery.
Okay. Salesman. Yeah. Okay. So yeah, I knew I didn't have the story completely right.
Steve is, God, I wish I could sum him. He pushes you so hard. I mean, he can be brutal. Oh my God. I'll tell you a quick story. Just as we were starting to fill the Bellagio lake, and it takes a good number of days to fill because of the water volume. And we were within a few days of filling it. And I was in another client's office or something here in LA, and the receptionist said, there's a Mr. Wynn on the phone for you. And I went in and picked it up. Hello, Steve. And he started to scream at me like, you cannot imagine. You could hear it all over the office, I'm sure. Because someone had told him that we had messed up and those little nozzles wouldn't be hidden, that when the wind blew and there would be waves, you know, troughs and peaks, that you would see the nozzles. And I was pretty sure we'd calculated that. But I said, Steve, I'm sure we're on top of that. If we're not, we'll fix it. And he was pretty articulate in telling me he wished he'd never met me, wished he could burn my contract up with the venom. And Steve is a powerful guy. And anyway, a few days later, we filled it, and the problem, it was okay. Now, Steve is a exceptionally handsome man. He radiates the sense of power and intelligence, which he has. And I'm a small person. I'm about 5'7". and so I'm standing. I'm thinking, now we've got to now create all these shows. And I'm sure I'm going to be working with Mr. Nguyen long into the future. And that was a colorful conversation. So I walked up to Steve, took three deep breaths and said, Steve, could we talk for a minute about that phone call a couple of days ago? And you know what he did? He stepped closer to me and he put his arm around my shoulder like a big bear hug. And he said, Mark, you just have to know, I was not mad at you. We just have to do fantastic work. We can't fall short on anything. I'm just passionate about the project. It wasn't about me mad at you. It was about we can't let anything go wrong. And he said, and if you thought I was yelling at you, I'm sorry. And I thought, I'm going to remember this day. How many billionaires tell somebody that they're sorry?
Yeah.
And I became a fan of Steve Nguyen on that very day. And he continued to once in a while scare me a little bit, but always inspire me and my team to get even more out of ourselves than we thought we could. And that's his gift. You can see it in everything he's touched.
Yeah. Stupid question. What's the water bill for like an average one of these fountain shows?
Well, the power, I don't know the water bill, because some of it is, I think they have a well or something that used to irrigate the golf course that was there formerly. But the last time I looked several years ago, I don't think power's changed too much, about $50 a show. So you got 5,000, I think the most they've ever had, they've had up to 30,000 people out there on the sidewalk to watch a show. And for $50 of electricity, I think that's pretty amazing.
Talk to me about the actual design process for this. Like, you know, what, you know, from sort of conception to actual, you know, execution to the final product that we see, like, does it start on pen and paper? Like, are you guys sketching? Like, what is the ideation process for something of this magnitude?
Yeah, it's exactly all of those things and a lot of other things. We're really big into building physical models and mock-ups. And of course, the wonders you can do with CAD models and 3D computer models is, of course, fantastic. And that's another tool. It's interesting sometimes when we're interviewing like a young engineer out of college, and if I say, hey, draw me a circle, where's the computer? Have you got SolidWorks installed so I can draw you a circle? And I'm thinking more like a napkin, right, and a piece of paper. Because the computers are great, but they instantly demand that you feed them all sorts of information about that circle. What should the line width be? What should the diameter be to the nearest, you know, tenth of a millimeter or something, whatever. And when you're in an ideation frame of mind, you've got this mind to hand sort of muscle, not just memory, but muscle connection. And if you watch somebody who can sketch, and we teach sketching here, just as they taught it to me at Stanford, just so you can get your ideas out. They don't have to be beautiful, but they flow fast that way. So we go through all those traditional sketching processes like that, and then we build small models and we tear them apart. We're not too precious about them, and bigger ones. And then we the place here is kind of like a movie studio. We've got a big old back lot and something you would call probably like a sound stage, where we control light and noise, and we end up building, and we have a fantastic scenic shop, wood shop. And we build kind of a movie set section, full scale, not of the whole thing, obviously, but of a piece of it, because water, if you do a miniature thing, the nozzles may be smaller, but gravity stays at 1.0. It doesn't go down just because the nozzle's smaller. So you have to really see what it's going to be like. Is it going to splash too much? Is it going to be as exciting or as beautiful as you thought? So everything we do, it goes through this incredible modeling process before we commit to, you know, construction drawings to build the actual piece.
Yeah. So, okay. You probably know this as well as anybody, right? You can model something down to perfection, but then when you go into an actual implementation, things go wrong. What went wrong? Like you mentioned earlier, there are things that weren't working. And you know, because you're talking about something probably with what, tens of thousands of moving parts with, you know, one variable that could totally screw up everything.
Yeah, what you said about models can fool you. Yes, you get a really bright young person in here, maybe fresh out of college, and they're a gee whiz at a 3D modeling program. I can do it on the screen. And I said, they'll say, I can build you a fantastic 3D model of anything you can imagine. And I say, well, first of all, it won't be 3D because I can run my hand across your screen. It's very 2D looking like 3D. But yes, you can not only model everything that will work in the real world, you can model everything that won't work. You can build me a fantastic computer model of a lightsaber. But if I ask you to build me a real one, you can't do it just because that model fooled you. That's called science fiction movies, right?
Yeah.
But if I ask you to build a model that works, of course, then all of a sudden all the impossible, you know, physics limited things are off the table. So that's the value of doing, yeah, at some stage, switching to the real thing. Oh, the problems we had. Well, some of them were absolutely crazy. We did what I said. We followed our preaching and we modeled these big shooters, we call them. They're, if you imagine a big old pipe, let's say, I don't know, 10 inches in diameter and 10 or 12 feet tall, you stick it in the lake and there's a little flapper valve on the bottom so that the water rushes in. And then when it's filled to the top, because the top of it's at the water level, the little flappers go shut on the bottom. So you got this sealed pipe full of water. Now, if I inject a big high pressure bubble of air in the bottom, it's kind of like if you shook a champagne bottle up and then release it, that air bubble would expand and it pushes the water out of the top. That's the technology we use. Fantastically more energy efficient and green than, pardon my cough, than if we use pumps. For reasons I can tell you if you're interested, but probably not. So I won't unless begged. So we built all those shooters and we mocked them up here. And we used air compressed at 120 PSI. If you go to Home Depot and you buy a compressor for your garage or something, it'll compress air up to about 120 pounds per square inch. But to get the height we wanted at Bellagio, we wanted to go twice that, 240. So we thought, well, what's the big deal? You can't buy a 240 pound compressor at Home Depot. So yeah, we'll take, there's no risk in that. So we were up there, the lake was filled, everything was full. Mr. Wynn was out there. We were just getting ready to start choreographing it. And we'd fire these shooters. And instead of, you've seen it, so you know what I mean? These missiles of water, they come out, they launch, and then they're disappeared. The jet would stick open. So it would look like Old Faithful on a bad day. It would just sputter and sputter, right? And it would destroy any sense of being tied to music. And you might, we have, what do we have, over 1,000 shooters of two different sizes there. But if one of them is stuck open, it's like if you go to a fancy dinner and you're all in whites and tails and you got a ketchup spot on your lapel. What's the only thing anybody will look at? It's that ketchup spot, right? So one of those jets, and even Mr. Wynn with his little bit impaired eyesight, what's wrong with that jet over there, Mark? And so we had all of our engineers, we had about 20, I don't know, just under 30 of them. We sent them to dive school because the lake's about 12 feet deep. They all got the PADI certified divers licenses while they're working on the project for us. So they would, a couple of them would go out, dive to the bottom, unbolt this shooter valve, bring it up to the surface. And we figured, oh, it's probably got dirt in it. You know, it's a construction site. Some dirt got in the air piping and, you know, it's the sand in it or something. So we'd set it on the work table and take it all apart and it was sparkling clean. And then we put it back together, go out there, dive, put it in, and boom, boom, it would work like $1 million. And then half an hour later, it would stick open again and do this horrible sputtering thing. And we were just mystified and we're getting uncomfortably close to opening. So I reached out, met the head of the fluid mechanics department at Caltech, and he did a computer model, very sophisticated, a reasonably sophisticated physics model of what was happening. And if you've ever painted something with a can of, you know, spray paint, you shake the little ball on the bottom, or hairspray or anything like that, if you hold the button down a long time, the can gets cold in your hand because as air expands, it absorbs energy to accomplish the expansion. It's a thermodynamic principle. So we had this air that we were now pressurizing to 240 PSI, very highly compressed. And then when we opened the valve, it expands to room temperature. It got so cold, and the professor modeled it, that air was dropping to minus 50 degrees. Now, this is in the lake, about 80 degree water in the middle of the summer in Las Vegas. And the air in going through that valve would drop to minus 50 degrees. And also, there's a little bit of humidity in all air, even in Las Vegas. So that moisture would freeze. And what was happening was was actually forming an ice ball inside the valve that would open and close, just like you were at the Arctic, and then that ice would stick it. And then this takes you to, what was the Ed Ground Post story where the murderer used a knife made of ice? I don't know if you remember that one. And he murdered somebody. And then when the cops came around, there was no murder weapon because it would have melted into a puddle of water by the time the cops got there. So our culprit here was these ice balls. As soon as the divers would take them apart and that 80-degree water would hit that ice ball, they were long since melted. There was no evidence when they got to the surface. So that's one of the crazy problems we had to work around.
Wow. You know, so one thing I wonder, because I talked to Wallace Nichols about this. He wrote a book, which I'm sure you're probably familiar with, called The Surprising Science of Water. And
I don't know that, and I'm going to have to get that.
So, you know, he and I were talking about why water has the effect on people that it does. And he was, you know, he's a surfer / marine biologist, and just surfing, it makes sense to me, right? He said, you know, the minute you get into the water, you know, you activate the default mode network, and, you know, you kind of, you know, are sort of like in a very different state of mind. And we actually had a very brief conversation about fountains. And, you know, the idea was that, you know, by meeting people near bodies of water, it changes the interaction that you have with them significantly. And I thought to myself, like, all right, from now on, anytime I go on a date, I'm going to make sure there's a fountain close by. Because I don't live in California anymore. But when I did, anytime I met somebody, you know, I would have them meet me at the beach, because especially as like podcast listeners, I'm like, all right, well, if I think you're an idiot, then at least I can get a surf session in. And if you're cool, then we're at this really beautiful place. But fountains in particular have this sort of magical quality to them, almost, particularly the ones that you design. Why is it that they have the sort of psychological impact on people that they do? Because, you know, like I said, I mean, to this day, anytime I've seen those fountains, I don't like going to Vegas. And you're right, it is one of the few places in Vegas where you don't feel like you're in Vegas, but it's spellbinding. Like, it's mesmerizing to watch, you know, I mean, and I wonder why that water in particular has that effect on people.
And I've given some thought to that, and I'll tell you kind of a surprising reason that I think it's true. And this comes from my theater background. In any good play, there's always a protagonist and an antagonist, right? Good guy, bad guy, fighting against each other. And they're separate individuals, of course. Water is simultaneously a protagonist and an antagonist. It's beautiful. We love to swim in it, like you say, ski on it when it's frozen, surf in it, splash around. Kids love to do it. And yet, all you have to do is turn on the television during a hurricane like Katrina, and you realize the terror that water can bring, and how destructive it can be. I read recently that the one thing that's in common among all sailors of all navies of all nations in the world is that their greatest fear is drowning. Now, you'd think somebody who's on a boat for their life would quickly get over that. They don't. So when water can snuff, I know if you have a small child at home, you have a swimming pool and the phone rings and you start to dash in to get it, immediately your heart will race. You think, God, 30 seconds, my baby could drown. So it has in itself this charm, this seductive, it's sensual when you feel it against your body, and it can take a life or 100 or 1,000 lives and laugh it off. You know, that's an amazing property. I can't think of anything else. I mean, fire destroys a lot of stuff, and in very small amounts we can enjoy it. But at a grand scale, water mixes that that sense of joy and almost playful, inconsiderate destruction together. So there has to be some way that touches us. Especially when, I don't know what the number is, but what is it? We're 82% water or something physically. Yeah. When the JPL guys go to look for life on another planet, they don't look for life. They look for water, because if there's no water, ain't going to be no life. and we all come from water on a small scale, you know, from our mother's womb. On a large scale, evolved from the oceans. So there's these hereditary million-year-old connections. And then there's that psychology of something. I guess like if you were dating a serial killer or something, but you thought he or she was just so attractive, you're going to do it anyway. That's a crazy analogy. But I want to cut that out of this.
It's funny to hear you sort of talk about both the destructive and beautiful qualities of water, because as a surfer, you kind of experience the same thing, right? There are days when you go out there and, you know, you feel like the ocean is like your greatest lover. And then there are days when they're like, this is the most indifferent lover on the planet who wants to basically hand my ass to me.
Yeah, that's it right there.
Yeah. Wow. Wow. So to go back to you know, what Steve Wynn said, you know, about this being the greatest work of your life, it kind of reminds me of sort of that Elizabeth Gilbert speech, right? It's like, how do you follow and eat, pray, love? So for you, when you've done something that is this grand, this known, because I'm sure everybody listening to this probably knows about the Fountains of Bellagio, and I know you've done a ton of other stuff that's also of huge magnitude, but that's kind of, in a lot of ways, I mean, to me, the minute I read that, I was like, yeah, that was what got me. So how do you maintain a sense of sort of, you know, creative persistence and not be forever defined by this one thing?
Yeah, like an actor who doesn't want to be thought of as a cowboy all his life, if that was his first role. Yeah. Early on, I was standing by one of our fountains, and I overheard somebody say, "Wow, I never knew water could do that before." And that phrase struck in my mind. I thought maybe that should be our judgment if we hear that. So we take one of the most ordinary substances on the planet. We all take it for granted. We don't normally look at it even twice. And if we can bring out an aspect of its personality or its essence or its being, that will be a pretty good achievement. And then I had, in the fairly early days of the company, we'd done, maybe a couple dozen features. And someone called me up, somebody that I guess I'd gone to school with, and said, "I just saw a fountain, shopping center. Was that yours?" And I said, "Yes, it was." He said, "I knew it. I know your work. And there's just some quality to it that without reading a sign or anything, it's yours." So we always look for those ways of just catching people's interest in the most ordinary thing in the world and allowing them to see it freshly with the eyes of a child when you see something new for the first time. That's a challenge because water's all around us, but that's really the goal.
Wow. So two final questions for you. I mean, you've accomplished what would be, you know, a massive degree of success by any measure. How has your personal definition of success changed with age and life experience?
I think I share this with Steve Jobs and Walt Disney and a few other of the people that are my heroes. And that is, I don't measure success by piling up money. Now, I'm a capitalist, and I'm not ashamed to say that. And money is incredibly useful to have. Yeah. But I think if you do really great things, and you have to work hard to get to that point, then you know, people are attracted to them, and you can make money, and that's what enables you to do the next great thing. So I like to, in my own way, with my own medium, and whenever I say I'm speaking for my whole team of several hundred people here, we love touching people. When you mentioned standing at the Bellagio, and you could look to your left while you're there, and it might be Rupert Murdoch with his billions standing on one side of you, and it might be a homeless person standing to the other side, and they're both there. Neither of them paid a nickel to see that feature because our business model doesn't require the ultimate viewer or user to pay, and they're happy, and we see people all the time. They propose there, they hug each other, they hug strangers. We coined a phrase a little bit. What do we do here? Well, we don't really create fountains. We create magnets for human connection, because you connect with the people that you're with. It just makes you, I don't know, you feel good. Like we said, that essence of water. You connect with your inner self, I think. I get very contemplative when I'm in, it's kind of like when you go to the Muir Woods or something, when you're in an environment where you're just all inspired by something of nature. And seeing water on the scale, Bellagio certainly does that. And then you connect directly with nature itself, which is harder and harder to do because everything wants to be on a 4K res screen these days instead of the real thing. And we have not evolved to relate to things on screens to the degree we relate to the real stuff.
Mm-hmm. Wow. Beautiful. Well, I have one last question for you. Which is how we finish all of our interviews at The Unmistakable Creative. What do you think it is that makes somebody or something unmistakable?
To make something unmistakable?
Yeah.
Share with me just a little more what you mean by unmistakable.
Yeah, well, it's kind of funny when the moment that you said that somebody looked at something you did and they knew it was yours, that is my definition of unmistakable.
Okay, right.
That's my personal definition.
Right. No, that's perfect definition. Meaning unique enough that it's not confused with anything else.
Yeah.
I know you've asked that to some really amazing people. I think you have to clear away all of the, I'm going to call them templates. You know, we all work on Word and stuff, and everything's so much easier if you got a template and you just fill in the blanks. And I think that's one of the worst things in life. Would you propose to somebody? Would you download some proposal templates? The things that really matter in life have to be built word by word, stick by stick, originally, and then they will be unmistakable. And I think most of us are sophisticated enough that we can spot something that originated on a template. I mean, I'm asked all the time, Mark, why the heck do you spend all the time, and it takes a lot of time, choreographing one of these? Surely computers and AI and stuff, they can figure out how to move the water to the music. Well, that's because we don't move the water to the music. We're inspired by it, and we create a set of moves that feel right for it. But if you had the Rockettes lined up and you computerized version of the Rockettes, and you said every time you hear a middle C, you kick your left leg 6 inches high, you that's what you'd get. Or maybe some more interesting variation on that with AI. But that would be derived from a formula. An AI is just a massive series of interactive formulas. And I don't think the human mind is. So you start with the classic statement, white sheet of paper, clear mind, not a variation on something you or somebody else has done. I mean, you're informed by that, but then you build it brick by brick, not filling in the blanks between sentences that just have blanks here and there.
Amazing. Well, I can't thank you enough for taking the time to join us and share your story, your wisdom, and your insights with our listeners. This has been fascinating. Where can people find out more about you, your work, and everything they're up to?
Well, right now, you can probably catch us on a lot of the news shows and on our Instagram page and whatnot, because we just finished a fantastic film. And I will say, I think it's the best work we've done in our whole life. At the Dubai Expo 2020, it's totally different than anything we've ever done. It's got huge queue lines. I'm told it's the most popular thing, and the whole expo is fantastic. And we're seeing it's the biggest and best exposition on the planet. So if you the name of it is Surreal, Surreal, or just Dubai Dubai Expo Water Feature. And then our website, which is Wet Design, as one word, wetdesign.com, either the mobile version or the laptop version.
Awesome. And for everybody listening, we'll wrap the show with that.
Thank you for listening to this episode of the Unmistakable Creative Podcast. While you were listening, were there any moments you found fascinating, inspiring, instructive, maybe even heartwarming? Can you think of anyone, a friend or a family member who would appreciate this moment? If so, take a second and share today's episode with that one person, because good ideas and messages are meant to be shared.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here. And it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.
Have you ever felt a twinge of worry about AI taking over your job or diluting your creativity? Well, what if you could turn that fear into creative fuel? We've just published an amazing new ebook called The 4 Keys to Success in an AI World, and this is more than just a guide. It's a deep exploration into the human skills that AI can't touch, the skills that are essential for standing out and thriving no matter how much technology evolves. We're talking about real differentiators here like creativity, emotional intelligence, critical thinking, and much more. Inside, you'll find actionable insights and strategies to develop these skills, whether you're a creative person, a business person, or just simply someone who loves personal development. This isn't a story about tech taking over. It's a story of human creativity thriving alongside AI. Picture this, AI as your creative co-pilot, not just as a tool, but a collaborator that enhances your unique human skills. The Four Keys ebook will show you exactly how to do that and view AI in a new way that empowers you instead of overshadows you. Transform your creative potential today. Head over to unmistakablecreative.com/4keys. Use the number 4, K-E-Y-S. That's unmistakablecreative.com/4keys. And download your free copy.